support comes from Marburn Academy, inviting you to a new community grandparent and parent seminar titled Help, My Grandchild Has ADHD, featuring author Judy Kersner. It's tomorrow at 7 p.m. A reservation for this open seminar is required. More information at marburnacademy.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. It has been 2 weeks since the federal budget cuts known as the sequester took effect. The sequester and its automatic across-the-board cuts was designed to be so politically unpalatable that it would force a compromise between Democrats and Republicans. Well, because unpalatable politics is the new normal in Washington, the two sides refused to compromise, and the cuts took effect. The White House continues to warn of the negative effects of the sequester. Here's President Obama speaking at Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois on Friday.
One of the reasons I was opposed to these cuts is because they don't distinguish between wasteful programs and vital investments. They don't trim the fat, they cut into muscle and into bone. Like research and development being done right here that not only gives a great place for young researchers to come and ply their trade, but also ends up creating all kinds of spin-offs that create good jobs and good wages.
This hour, the impact of the sequester and outlooks for a grand bargain on the budget. Joining us is Marilyn Giewack. She is senior business editor for NPR. She joins us from Washington. Welcome to the show, Marilyn.
Hi, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start first with the basics. Okay, real quickly. Let's run through some definitions, because over the past, 3 months, we've heard everything from fiscal cliff to sequester to continuing resolution. What is the sequester?
Well, I'm tempted to say la, 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 la.
Yeah.
But if we have to talk about it, and we do because it is an important issue, I think it's important to break out the definitions just because there have been so many of these so-called crises that they all start to run together.
Yeah, so maybe we should start with the definition of crisis.
Right. Well, these are, of course, human-made crises, so they are cobbled together by our political leaders, but we have had a series of cliffs and crises and what have you, so let's just take them a little bit one at a time. Back in December, you heard a lot of talk about a fiscal cliff, and that was because there were all sorts of issues that were all coming together at one time. So Congress actually decided to pull them apart a little bit and push them off so that we'd have not just one giant cliff, but a series of events that they would have to sort out. So the first one that they took care of back in December, that had to do with tax cuts. There were the Bush-era tax cuts had been set to expire. So unless Congress took some action, those all of those tax breaks would expire. A lot of people thought that would hurt the economy. So a compromise was worked out, and as of January 1st, some of the taxes on the wealthiest Americans went up, and the rest of the tax breaks stayed in place.
Except for the Social Security
that
brief cut, so folks who collect Social Security saw an increase.
Killing you. Yeah. That's right. That's the payroll tax holiday, which was a two-year tax holiday on your Social Security taxes, that expired and they allowed that to go forward. So everybody saw more taxes come out of their paycheck. The average paycheck lost about $20 a week, but wealthier people saw even more than that. Of course, it hurt a lot of the lower-income workers who suddenly, just at the very time that gas prices were starting to shoot up, you were seeing more coming out of your paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
So that made for a pretty tough January and February for a lot of people as they adjusted to higher gas prices and less pay.
But crisis averted, though, right? Crisis averted.
Yeah, at least, in a sense, we did manage to start the new year. Well, not quite. We were already into the new year,
yeah.
But the deadline was actually December 31st. But they limped over the finish line before the new year in terms of business really got started. So we settled a lot of tax issues. And, that was good because at least it took some uncertainty off the table. That chunk of it was settled. So the part that we were focused on taxes in December, that part of the deal is done. Now, the next thing that was set to happen on January 1st was this process called sequestration. That's a strange word to use, but you've heard it before during the OJ trial and other legal events. Sometimes you'll hear about a judge who will say, we're going to sequester the jury. And we all know that means they're going to sit in the hotel and order good food, and hide out from the media until they come to a conclusion. So when you sequester something, you're setting it aside with the legal right to do so. You're not kidnapping the jury. You're not falsely imprisoning them. You are legally sequestering them. So this process refers to Congress's legal power to take money that had already been appropriated and set it aside, to sort of put it in a lockbox, just as the judge can put the jury aside. So that money has now been sequestered. And what they did was, across the board, said, we're going to come up with a bunch of painful cuts that amount to about $85 billion a year. And they're very across the board. They're not well thought out. They're not specific. They don't eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. They just cut everything across the board for the programs that they hit. Now, let me just say that they don't hit Social Security and Medicare. Those programs were held harmless. But it's the defense budget that's taking a really big hit, all sorts of social programs and things that, medical research, Border Patrol, FBI, all kinds of things that many people would consider important. Those programs are being hit across the board.
All right. Marilyn Giewax, the senior business editor at National Public Radio, or NPR, is our guest on All Sides today. We're talking about the impact of the sequestration now that we are a couple of weeks into the cuts, the automatic budget cuts that took effect 2 weeks ago.
March 1st. That's when they separated them out. They put the taxes on January 1st, and then they put sequestration March 1st.
So, Marilyn, just when are we going to feel the effects of this sequestration?
Well, now that we have it actually in effect, sequestration did go, as I said, they were trying to push these dates apart a little bit. So March 1st, that actually took effect. And you may be thinking, so why don't I feel it yet? Well, that's because they have to give people 30-day notice for a lot of these furloughs. Now, that means that actually there's a sort of another crisis coming then when they actually take effect after March 1st. So we'll all get back from Easter, come back on Easter Monday, and you'll be facing the start of the real effects of sequestration.
But what will we see, though?
Well, one of the things that's supposed to happen is the way they've got it set up is, for example, civilian defense workers will be furloughed one day a week. That is, instead of working a five-day week, you'll only work a four-day week. That might sound good until you realize you're losing 20% of your pay. And for a lot of people, your payroll taxes are up, you're losing 20% of your pay. For many families who are defense workers, shipbuilders, and all sorts of civilian kind of work that you do for the federal government, you can be in the Pentagon, all sorts of places, those jobs, you're really going to start to feel it when you go to go grocery shopping and your paycheck is 20% less.
We're going to feel that here in Central Ohio. We have a defense accounting center and a large civilian defense force here on the east side of Columbus in the Whitehall area. And those are the folks who would be directly affected. And local officials there are worried about, obviously the impact on the economy when those folks now have 20% less of their paycheck to spend on things, but also they get 20% less income tax from these folks who are working in places like Whitehall.
So if you're running a restaurant nearby and every Friday a bunch of workers would come in at lunchtime and now they're not going to be there on Friday, you can start to sense how that will ripple out. But because there's always another but with Congress and always another deadline, can I just say this other point? There's another deadline, and that may affect things. That's March 27th, which is coming up next week. There's a continuing resolution. You'll hear this phrase, CR, a great deal in the next couple of days. What that refers to, and that can have an effect on all of this sequestration, is the government has never been able to agree on a budget since April of 2009. I mean, we've gone for years now without a formal budget, and because Congress can't ever come to any kind of agreement, they just keep doing this thing called a continuing resolution. Instead of actually passing a budget that shapes the budget, they just keep saying, okay, well, just keep going with last year's budget. So the current continuing resolution was set for 6 months. The government works on a fiscal year that starts on October 1st. So they had a six-month CR. That's expiring. So for the government to continue to operate without completely shutting down, they need another continuing resolution to get us to limp through till the end of September, till September 30th. So as they put together that continuing resolution in this coming week, this very week that we're in, they're trying to possibly work out a deal while they're doing this to soften the blow of sequestration, to at least give the agencies, they're not going to reduce the amount of money that has to be cut. They're sticking with that. There doesn't seem to be any chance on undoing sequestration as a bottom line figure, but they could give the agencies more flexibility to in how they shut things down. They may take a look at what the operations are in Columbus and say, wow, those are like really vital. We're not going to do that. We'll do something else. We'll delay the start of a different project or shift it around somehow to try to soften some of the impact of this. So we don't know yet the outcome of whether or not they'll be able to soften some of the worst effects of the sequestration.
We're speaking with Marilyn Giewax. She is Senior Business Editor for National Public Radio. We are talking about the sequestration and all the budget dealings or non-dealings that are not happening in Washington, D.C., as the two sides try to find some way to reduce the federal budget deficit and come to some agreement on taxes, on cuts. And as Marilyn has mentioned, it's just one crisis, alleged crisis after another. We'd like your phone calls, 292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org and look for us on Twitter and on Facebook. Marilyn, you know, the lead up to the sequestration, the lead up to March 1st, reminded me of local tax levy campaigns here in Ohio. If you don't pass the levy, all of the kids are going to have to walk to school uphill both ways. If you don't pass the levy, we're not going to have any firefighters. Are all of those threats that the Obama administration was making, are they going to come true?
Honestly, we'll have to see. I mean, there's a certain amount of, was this intended to make everything, exaggerated so that Congress would do what the president wanted? Or really, is he honestly trying to warn us about what's about to happen? We won't know until these furloughs really kick in. And it's possible, as I say, if Congress shifts things around to make it not so crazy, maybe it really won't be that bad. But if they fail to act and it does take effect as it was originally written, the sequestration was intended to inflict harm on the economy. They intended it to be so crazy that no one would let it happen. Now, let me just explain why it's such a strange piece of legislation. The way this came up was back in the summer of 2011, Congress was wrestling with an issue of the debt ceiling. That is, the government was at the maximum allowable limit of what money it could borrow. The president said, we need to borrow a little bit more. Can you raise that debt ceiling? The Republicans were saying no. So they couldn't reach an agreement until finally the Republicans said, okay, we'll allow a debt ceiling, but only if we put a gun to our own heads and say we've got to come up with a solution or we're going to have this horrible process called sequestration take effect. And they still got to the deadline with sequestration, and they still couldn't make up their minds. So this thing that was intended to be harmful, it was intended to be so ridiculous that no one would allow it to happen, has in fact happened. So we're in pretty uncharted waters. I mean, it's kind of hard to say exactly what it's going to do. But let me explain why
Marilyn, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the impact of the federal budget sequestration, the automatic cuts that took effect March 1st, when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News.
It's 37 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect rain showers off and on throughout the day today, with thunderstorms possible this afternoon, a high of 51 degrees. Rain is likely tonight, possibly mixing with a little snow, a low of 30 degrees. And then some sunshine for Tuesday, but colder, a high of just 38. Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting dancer and choreographer Faye Driscoll's You're Me. The new critically acclaimed evening-length duet explores the complex nature of relationships, March 21st to March 23rd in the Wexner Center for the Arts. Details at wexarts.org. And support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid each year. ONU offers nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate. Junior Explore ONU Day is March 25th. Details at onu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the federal budget, the automatic sequestration cuts that went into effect on March 1st. We have yet really to feel the full impact of those cuts, and we'll try to figure out what that impact might be. If the predictions by the Obama administration of major inconveniences, if all those come true, and we'll try to figure out if there's any way that Congress, Republicans and Democrats, can reach a grand bargain on the deficit and we can move on to other things. Our guest, Marilyn G. Wax, senior business editor for NPR. She is an Ohio native. Marilyn, you're from the Youngstown area and you went to Ohio State University.
I sure did. I worked for the Ohio State Lantern, my first journalism job, and very proud of the things that you, the Buckeye journalists have accomplished over the years.
So how far do you have the Ohio State basketball team going in your pool?
That's where I count on my brother, who used to live in the stadium dorm. I have to email him and say, send me my brackets.
All right. Enough basketball. It's back to the serious stuff here.
This is Washington March Madness. You know, this is our version.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Is this a bigger story inside the Beltway than it is in the rest of the country?
You know, it's so weird because it's so... It's all so stupid in some ways. I mean, you just think, well, gosh, everybody actually agrees on so many points. Why don't they just come together and figure this out and just get it done already? For goodness sake, how many crises can we stand? So we all start to tune out, I mean, including everybody. I mean, people in Washington are sick of this topic. It's so tedious that this goes on and on and on. Remember, I said that this all started with back in summer of 11. We're coming into summer of 13. We haven't had a real budget since 09. This stuff is pretty slow and pretty tedious.
Life here in Columbus goes on, though the federal budget has not. Great. We haven't had a budget.
I think there's really a sense. You know, I go to a lot of economist conferences and get together with economists quite frequently, and there's sort of a sense that people feel like of almost giving up on Congress, that the economy's kind of moved on. People are just building houses this spring, and they're, you know, the auto industry's doing pretty well. Energy in Ohio, you know, when I go back to Youngstown, I see the impact of fracking on the economy, in a positive way in a lot of parts of the country, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, we're seeing jobs come back. So a lot of people feel like, you know, let's just move on and ignore Congress.
One place that's ignoring Congress is Wall Street. It's setting record highs the past couple of weeks. They don't seem to be bothered by this whole thing.
That's true so far. But here's the sad reality of it, is that Congress really can make a mess of this. If they don't, so far everyone has been able to ignore it. But at this point, we really are reaching a critical stage here where as these budget cuts, as sequestration starts to kick in, that people really, you know, will start to feel it. For example, one of the things that is targeted here is the FAA. Unless Congress figures out a way to soften the blow of this, we could see a lot fewer air traffic controllers this summer. Remember, I said that people will be getting furloughs of taking a day off every week, not getting overtime. Well, when you reach peak travel season, if you don't have enough TSA screeners to get people through the airport and you don't have enough air traffic controllers, and all of a sudden you're making it really difficult for people to travel because there are big flight delays, do people start to cancel vacations? Does that ripple out to hurt the rest of the economy in places where they have hotels, or, you know, if somebody was flying in to, go to Florida for spring break or something in April, and all of a sudden there's 3 and 4 hour lines at the airport, do they still make that trip? We'll have to see. I mean, it could end up having quite an effect on the economy.
Yeah, it came out last week that the it wouldn't affect, at least not right now, as far as we know, the control tower at the major airport in town at Port Columbus. But there are fears that control towers, because of a lack of staffing, control towers at OSU's airport, Don Scott Airport, and at Bolton Field, another small airport in the southwest part of town, they could lose those air traffic controllers. The airports would not shut down, but there would not be air traffic controllers there, and some flights may be diverted by their choice to Port Columbus for fear of, you know, safety and that kind of thing. So,
well, the consensus among economists, the typical thinking right now is that this will, at the very least, sequestration will shave about a half of a percentage point from our economic growth. So let's say the economy was going to grow at 2.9% this year, which would be, you know, reasonably good, not great, but pretty good. And then that falls down to 2.4 or 2.3, something like that. And that's pretty darn sluggish. That's probably the difference. They estimated that amounts to about 750,000 jobs. Well, you know, I mean, there's 12 million people already who are unemployed. If you add another 750,000 unemployed people to that pile, that's not good for the economy. That doesn't help anything. So there is a sense. I was on an economist conference call last week where they were talking about threats to the economy. And literally the single best, biggest threat to the U.S. economy right now is the U.S. Congress. So that's kind of a scary thought.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, you're everything else seems to be moving forward except for Washington. And But let me just toss in a note of optimism here. Amid all of this, sometimes it's the darkest just before the dawn, and there is a little sense that maybe this can all work out somehow in coming months. Here's why. Right now they're trying to keep the government. Remember I said we've got to get that CR done. We've got to get the continuing resolution done so that the government can continue to function past March 27th. They're working on that this week. Now, it's a mess of a bill. The Senate has a bill that they're supposed to work on this week. It's got nearly 100 amendments at this point. And Congress always wants to enjoy vacation. They want to start their Easter break on the 22nd. So they want to get this all wrapped up, knock out those 100 amendments and get this done. And so they can take a break and go home for Easter, and the government would be set on autopilot through the rest of the year.
But that doesn't solve the problem. That moves the money around a little bit. Maybe, you know, we don't lose as many air traffic controllers, but,
exactly.
You know, the $85 million is still there.
Is there a billion?
$85 billion,
we have to think
$85 billion, dollars, I'm sorry, is still there.
Right. But here's where the optimism comes in. If they can finally get past all of this sort of crazy stuff like the fiscal cliff in December and the sequestration March 1st and the continuing resolution of the 27th, if those things can be solved, now they actually have kind of a clean plate to work on coming up with a real budget going forward. And as I said, we haven't had a real budget blueprint for many years now. So this is actually the opportunity. This is that other phrase to define the grand bargain, where they really do want to, even Congress is bored with itself. I mean, on some level, everybody's just sort of sick of this. So if they could come up with a big package that cuts entitlements, does eliminate some tax loopholes to raise some revenues, blah, blah, blah. They could put together some sort of a deal that brings certainty and stability on a 10-year plan, like a much bigger budget, not just this stopgap stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a feeling, you know, maybe it's a false optimism, but right now I think there is a sense in Washington that somehow or other, amid all of this debris, they're going to come out with some kind of a structure this summer that will set the course for spending and taxes for the next, you know, chunk of time, for the next decade.
We here in Ohio are closer to Missouri than we are Washington, D.C., so our attitude is show me. We'll see.
Right.
We're talking with Marilyn Giewax, NPR senior business editor, about the sequestration and the ongoing budget talks. Let's go to the phones. And Rod, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Incidentally, you know, just a little personal note. My brother went to school with Marilyn. She, you know, they were both at the university about the same time.
Oh, great.
And I don't, you know, I want to give the name over the air, but like I said, you know, they were both in the journalism department. So at any rate, my question, or I guess you might say kind of a couple of comments here. Basically, I see the sequestration as kind of the result of the difference in philosophy between the two parties. And also, I think we have a philosophy in this country. I'm talking about, you know, individual people now. You know, some people want to hold on to their money as much as possible, while, you know, and basically don't want to help the poor and so forth. They, you know, they feel they should be pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, so to speak. And the idea of investing in the country, you know, things like infrastructure and, you know, making sure that we have safe food and water and so forth, you know, seems to have gone out of fashion.
Marilyn, reaction to that?
Well, that's the debate right now in Congress is where do we, how much do we fund today's activities? And, you know, while still there's a pretty wide recognition that because of all of us, the aging baby boomers, the people who are getting edging closer towards retirement when all of us in our 50s start moving into our 60s and 70s, that's going to be, you know, a huge burden for the government to deal with when, because of just the pure demographics of it, something like 78 million baby boomers moving into retirement years. And, of course, when you retire, you put less money into the system because you're no longer working and you're taking money out of it. And there are pretty good reasons to believe that those entitlement programs do need some reforms in one way or the other to make sure that they are on solid financial footing going into these baby boomer retirement years. But then there's a whole bunch of other discussion right now. I mean, the really hot topic is how do we get the economy to grow again, and many people are really in favor of a more the democratic approach, which is create more jobs now, and that will create income, get those 12 million people who are not paying income taxes, get them back into the labor force by spending money on infrastructure and programs and, you know, school teachers, firemen, police, et cetera. And there are other people who are saying, no, you know, the biggest problem for the government right now is the tax code is too complicated and too burdensome. So we need to simplify and lower taxes. So it's a great debate. I mean, it's one that's gone on in this country pretty much forever. You know, I'm sure Alexander Hamilton dealt with this, 200 years ago. So it's just something that goes on and on about what is the correct level of spending for infrastructure and what's the correct level of taxation. And that's the big battle right now.
292-8513 is our phone number. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about federal budget sequestration, the grand bargain, which most people are hoping Democrats and Republicans can make a grand bargain and solve this budget situation, at least for the next few years, and move on. Our guest, Marilyn G. Wax, senior business editor with NPR, Ohio native, Ohio State alum. She joins us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. Marilyn, it goes to the, you talk about this has gone on since Andrew Jackson, but the way I see it is when times are tough, money is short, government cuts. When times are good, government spends more, and they cut taxes when times are good. It sounds like it should be reversed. You know, when times are tough, government should spend more, cut taxes, but raise taxes when times are good. But that never seems to happen.
Well, these are, you know, human beings,
yes.
And we, you know, we tend to react to what's in front of us at the moment. I mean, people in Europe are right now, you know, going through a lot of troubles because of austerity. They got into trouble because they borrowed too much money. Then they tried to cut government spending, and that they've had a lot of job losses over there. There's Spain, I think the last time I looked, had like 25% unemployment. You know, they've been trying to get their government spending under control, but in the process, they're losing a lot of jobs. There has been a theory in this country that you need to spend more, and that's since the 1930s. I know back in Ohio, when I was in high school, I swam in a swimming pool that was built by the WPA, you know, from the 1930s. The high school stadium where we watched football was built by the WPA in the 1930s. So there were a lot of jobs that were created. My dad was in the CCC camps, you know, so he was a civilian worker. And there were many jobs created that left a lot of infrastructure and created a lot of jobs for people. And there are many who would say that was a good thing, that those were all good investments in, from the Hoover Dam to my high school football stadium. Those were things that helped build America for the future, and it created jobs for people like my dad. Mm-hmm. Other people would say, you know what, actually the Depression dragged on for years and years because the government was in the way, and we actually would have done better to try to stimulate private enterprise instead of trying to have the government hire people. That's a you know, an argument that's gone on forever. And I just want to say, if I said Andrew Jackson, do you know what I meant? I meant Alexander Hamilton.
Excuse me to
our founding fathers of various sorts, but
I'm sure Andrew Jackson had his problems too.
He did too. He actually did with the infrastructure, but I actually was trying to refer to Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary, who wrestled with a lot of these issues about what was the correct level of taxation and investment in the future. So
all those history buffs can now put the phone down because we have corrected our error.
And to any history professor from OSU who is out there, I'm sorry, just had a misspoke, but I remember my classes from Ohio.
I think Julius Caesar also had issues with his budget back in the day.
Yes, they all do.
292-8513 if you'd like to call, or allsides@wosu.org is our email. We're talking about budget cuts, federal budget, and the deficit with Marilyn Giwack, senior business editor with NPR. Defense is getting a 10% cut, and here's what the Army Times writes. The United States' top military officers have warned that sequestration would be ruinous for national security. They warned of an era of scant training and little maintenance on aging combat systems. And they warned that a new national defense strategy would be unworkable. To hear the top generals and admirals tell it, the U.S. military would be reduced to regional power status because of this 10% cut. That sounds like hyperbole there.
That sounds a little extreme, but, you know, stay in touch a lot with the people in the, especially in the aerospace industry, and here's the thing about a lot of this is it takes a long time to put things into the pipeline to make something come out on the other end. You'd have to do a lot of research and development. You have to have trained workers. So if there are interruptions in the early stages when something is being developed, you could set a program back dramatically. And that's certainly true, not just with the military, but remember, a lot of the cuts here are also affecting the National Institutes for Health. The NIH does research on medical things.
Yeah, but I want to spark just on the military, Marilyn.
Okay.
Our military budget is 6 to 7 times larger than the budget of China, which is our next biggest rival, and is more than the next 20 largest military spenders combined. Can we really say that a 10% cut is going to put us back to, you know, the military level of France?
Yeah, that's something folks can debate. I think there are a lot of people who are very skeptical about what the generals are saying. But let me say this. Here's why sequestration is so frustrating to people. If I told you your pay is going to be cut by, let's say, 10%, and you have to accept that and deal with it, would you cut your mortgage payment by 10% and just short the bank, just send in a check that doesn't match what you owe every month, and then send in 10% less to your car company, to your lender there, and cut everything just evenly 10% across the board? Well, that's kind of a goofy way to do your budget, because you're going to get the bank pretty mad at you, and they could put you into foreclosure. The auto lender might come and repossess your car. So instead of doing that, you would set sensible priorities. You might say, you know what, honey, we are going to keep making the house payment, and we're going to keep making the car payment, and the kids are going to have food, but we're going to cut out the vacation this year. We're not going to take that trip because that's an extra. We don't need to do that. And we're going to cut out, you know what, she can wear the same Easter dress she wore last year. We're not going to get new clothes this spring. You can make decisions that make sense for your family to protect it, to make sure that you have shelter and transportation and food. So what they're saying with the sequestration cuts is not turning to the Pentagon and saying, let's get rid of the things that you don't really absolutely need. you know, let's not start some project that may or may not work out. Let's figure out what is really a core important program, and we'll save that and we'll cut other things. That's not how it works in sequestration. It's across the board. And that's why people are so frustrated with it, because it's as goofy as if you tried to cut all of your payments in your own home by 10% instead of picking priorities.
We'll pick up on that discussion in just a moment. We're talking about the federal budget and sequestration and the impact it might have. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and we'll look long-term at the chances of finally getting our budget, the federal budget deficit under control and move on to other things. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, 10 years after the American invasion of Iraq, we weigh the price and lessons of the war that followed. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in just about 20 minutes. Hour two of All Sides begins. We will have a discussion of the verdict in the Steubenville case, and we will also have an open forum. That's All Sides from 11 till noon. 36 degrees with some showers today, maybe a pop-up thunderstorm, a high of 51. Rain tonight mixing with a little snow and a low of 30 degrees. Partly sunny and a high of 38 on Tuesday. Support comes from the Columbus Symphony. On stage with the Ballet Met to perform Stravinsky's Rite of Spring this Friday through Sunday at the Ohio Theater. The performance celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Rite of Spring's riot-inducing premiere in Paris. Details and tickets at columbussymphony.com. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the federal budget, sequestration, debt reduction, taxes, spending. Our guest, Marilyn G. Wax, senior business editor with NPR. Marilyn, you mentioned and I've heard that analogy a lot about how if we were told to cut 10%, we wouldn't be able to cut 10% of our mortgage payment or our car payment. But does that hold true because this sequestration does not affect Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid? Those, you could argue, are the federal government's mortgage payment, car payment. They have to make those, and they're asking them to cut other places.
Well, the
cable bill, you know, cell phone, that kind of thing.
In some ways, it's so skewed because you're right that so much of government spending is for Social Security and Medicare. So if you take those two programs out of the mix, then people will say, well, I've heard the argument, well, you know, this $85 billion is not that much. It's only, you know, whatever, 2% of the federal government spending or whatever. But if you take those giant programs out of the mix and then you leave it with just the rest of the spending,
the impact is greater.
And the impact is really magnified because you're not spreading it across all programs. And then specifically, sequestration was designed to have half of those cuts focus on defense.
Let's get to some
calls.
So
they are pretty big.
Let's get to some calls here. Carl. Hi, Carl. You're on the air with Marilyn G. Wax from NPR.
Hi, yes. My question is, I'm wondering how sequestration will affect local programs in Central Ohio, particularly those related to poverty and programs like Head Start.
Yes, there will be a pretty big impact on Head Start. I'm not sure where the number ends up for Ohio on the number of teachers, but it's quite significant. There will be a lot of cuts that involve teachers, teacher aides, so in regular school programs as well as the Head Start. And again, this gets back to that idea of what do you cut in your family budget? Do you cut out the vacation or do you cut the kids' school? I mean, you know, it's an interesting choice to select Head Start programs for young children and say that's where we want to cut because you know, those things can have long-term impacts on the economy, not just affecting this year's budget. But, you know, because of the way sequestration was structured, that's where we're at. So another thing that a lot of people would be feeling like they're kind of scratching their heads is some estimates are that we'll lose 1,000 FBI agents, and as well as Border Patrol. Now, you know, probably pretty good reasons to want to keep the borders secure. There are probably pretty good reasons to have law enforcement up to full capacity. So, I mean, any one of these programs you want to point to, there are a lot of people who are not so pleased about less law enforcement, fewer firefighters and fewer teachers, and big cuts in Head Start. Those are certainly things people may want to debate with their members of Congress.
Marilyn G. Wax, the senior business editor with NPR. We're talking about sequestration here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ann from Jefferson Township. Go ahead, please.
Yes. All this talk about sequestration and stuff, as a former federal employee, I get extremely angry because the executive branch, all those legislators, senators, lawmakers, none of them come underneath OPM rules, and so therefore none of them get hit by stuff for not actually performing their job. I would love to have that subject along with what their entitlements cost, and it's never touched.
All right. Let's touch it now.
That's certainly that is the case. Congress will continue to go along its way. Members of Congress won't be taking 20% pay cuts. You know, the civilian defense workers, about 40% of them are veterans. So there are an awful lot of people out there who are fresh home from a war, and they got a job as a defense worker, and they're about to lose 20% of their pay, which, you know, they may have some questions about why people who are members of Congress and in the White House are not similarly suffering, but that is not how sequestration was set up. She's right that it will affect people who are not members of Congress.
All right. We're talking about the federal budget and sequestration with Marilyn G. Wax from NPR here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. From Ladd on Facebook, he says, here's an idea to cut the federal budget. Eliminate ridiculous programs. Now, he points to a program where we have robotic squirrels. I have no idea if we have a program for robotic squirrels. Ladd thinks we do. He also suggests eliminating corporate and industry subsidies, means test Medicare and Social Security. And he suggests that might lead to a surplus and not a deficit.
Mm-hmm. I can't say as I've ever here in Washington met the robot squirrels, but I will say that it's very possible for people to tease out a certain program, describe it in a really foolish way, and say it sounds nuts. But no, it's very hard to say without knowing more facts about any particular program if they're worthy or not. For example, when the government invented the Internet, of course, that was a defense program. DARPANET, one of the defense sections, worked on the Internet. And you could have said in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, what are we wasting money on, a bunch of guys sitting around stroking their beards, these hippies are trying to hook up wires so they could send each other little messages. What's the point of that? Well, you know, the point ended up being the Internet, and it's completely changed, you know, human history.
Yeah.
There are other programs that you could say, you know, well, what are they tinkering around with little rockets for? And, well, you know, there were an awful lot of spin-offs that have come from the space program. You know, in any given medical research program, I can't defend or argue for or against because everyone is different. I'm sure that there are programs that are a waste of time and effort, but there are others that may seem foolish to outsiders. But in the end, you know, government did do things like, I mean, they created the Centers for Disease Control and wiped out malaria in this country. So was that just a couple of guys walking around in little white jackets in the South in the 1930s, or were those people who were going to completely transform health in America because of their epidemiology work? It's hard to say.
To Ladd's bigger point about means testing Medicare and Social Security, the president has said in these personal meetings he's had with members of Congress, Republican members of Congress in particular, that he supports entitlement reform, reforms to Medicare, to Social Security, to Medicaid. How serious is and how much reforming is the White House willing to do?
Well, because these are negotiations, it's kind of, you know, if you've ever been in a union and you have labor and management and you know how negotiations go, nobody gives completely reveals what their bottom line is. So this has to play out over the next several months. But I think there is a pretty widespread agreement from the president to everybody would agree that as the programs are currently structured, they do have some problems just purely on demographic reasons. I mean, as I say, baby boomers are aging, and they're going to need to make some kind of tweaks to the system to keep it stable for over the long haul. So I don't think that the president is kidding when he says he is willing to make some changes in the entitlement programs. And it's on the table. He's offering to change how inflation is calculated. There are many economists who say that the way the inflation adjustments are calculated are not quite correct, and they overstate inflation. So if we made just that tweak to use a system that most economists, they call it chained CPI, Consumer Price Index, it would be a fair reading of what inflation really is for the elderly, and it would lower costs over time because each year it would be tweaked a little bit.
Well, Democrats, the problem is Democrats on the left side of the Democratic Party, the far left, they don't want any changes to Medicare. They want to see basically taxes on the wealthy, tax loopholes cut. And they don't think that there should be any cuts or any major changes to these support services, these entitlement programs.
That's true. There are people who have that opinion. I would say at the moment, most of the Democrats in Congress who are in a position to really shape these negotiations, as well as the White House, are not quite that far to the left. They do believe that there should be some changes to the system to that people would maybe interpret as cutting them, but something where they're willing to give up some things in order to get some things. And so those negotiations, one can hope that they will come together with some sort of a grand bargain probably by around in July.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones. 292-8513 is our number. If we have a few minutes left, if you'd like to try to jump in, let's go to Paul in Bexley.
Hi. Just kind of picking up on what you've been talking about, a couple of points. Social Security is a separate program. It's not part of the general budget. Might need some tweaking, but it's kind of frustrating to always hear it thrown into the conversation about the general budget when it's not. That could be easily fixed by increasing the maximum level at which it's taxed instead of 110 or whatever thousand it is now. If they raise that, that could be easily fixed, and they wouldn't have to change the amount of people, what they get on Social Security. The second thing is Medicare Part D could make changing that so that the government could negotiate the prices on drugs rather than having to pay full retail prices, thanks to our Republican friends in Congress, could save billions of dollars and do a lot to stabilize that program. And it's awfully easy to talk about, you know, a couple thousand or $1,000 here or there if they go to the chain, is it CPI or CRP calculation? But, you know, you're talking a difference of $1,000 or more dollars a year, and if that's the only income a person has, that's significant.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get a reaction. Thanks, Paul. Marilyn, those are all things that have been talked about. It sounds easy. It looks great on paper, but politically,
yeah,
it's impossible to get,
always,
to get done.
Always fun to go up against the pharmacy lobby. Well, there are a lot of people who would say that that really the core problem is not anything to do with the budget. It's all about rising medical care costs. So there is a body of thought that really what needs to be addressed here is figuring out how to get the government to not just move things around and trim programs, but to really go after how you structure the cost of the drugs that people so often take, and can you buy them, you know, in such a way that it would really lower the cost. But that's, you know, as we saw during the Affordable Care Act, it's very tough to argue cases that involve healthcare and spending on the pharmaceuticals, on the healthcare industry. Those are all very bruising battles. So
to avoid the bruising battles, Marilyn, you know, back in the 90s, you know, when the Cold War had ended and military spending was being reduced and we didn't need all of the bases that we had around the country, they formed this thing called the Base Closure Commission. And they looked at what bases we needed, and they made recommendations on which bases to close. And Congress had to take the list in its entirety, up or down. They couldn't save their pet little base. Why can't Congress do something similar with the budget? Say, look, we're going to have this commission, Simpson-Bowles Commission, something like that, say, here's what we need to do to raise taxes, cut spending, to fix our budget long term. You can vote, but you got to vote either up or down.
See, Mike, you're going all logical on me. That's because you're back there in Ohio. I'm here in Washington. I can't tell you why they don't do something that would make sense. It's just very tough. The issues are very divisive. House Speaker Boehner has his hands full trying to coordinate with the White House, with members of his own party who sometimes disagree with him. These battles are very complicated, and the things that's why I say it as we started this hour, there are a lot of frustrated people who almost just can't believe that it could be so impossible when there ought to be solutions like this. Turn it over to a super committee, have them cut a deal and get it done. Well, that's how we ended up with sequestration. Mm-hmm. There was supposed to be a group of very smart members of Congress.
Rob Portman from Ohio was on
right,
the committee.
And a lot of smart cookies out there, the best brains in the Congress, were going to sit down and come up with just what you're describing and get this done, and it should have been done a year, you know, in 2011. So I guess that's what, you know, year and a half ago, and it didn't happen. Nothing happened. The super committee was a complete waste of time. They never
that was a year before an election. You think we have a better shot now that we're 3 years out?
Well, hence the guarded optimism of the moment. As I said, there's sort of a sense out there based on a little clues that people gave on the morning talk shows this past week that, well, maybe I can give up a little bit on here or there. There is a sense that maybe this time they can actually come up with something, because if they don't do it now, when are they?
Yeah.
I mean, the election is done. This is sort of the sweet spot, and so we'll see.
All right. Thanks very much, Marilyn G. Wax. And Marilyn, congratulations. You never once uttered the words charm offensive.
There you go.
So we successfully made...
You were charming me.
We admire your optimism at a grand bargain. Thanks very much.
Well, it's always great to talk with my Buckeyes. Go Bucks. Let's see what happens with the basketball version of March Madness.
All right. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.